Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day to help you improve your American English skills and tell you about our world at the same time. Today, we begin with some interesting information about safety and the Internet. Mary Gottschall has details.
The global cybersecurity market is expected to grow 121% in the next 5 years, says a new study. The size of the industry will grow from $77 billion in 2015 to $170 billion in 2020, reports the Indian research firm Markets and Markets. The cybersecurity market is rising at a very fast rate. The digital age has brought a variety of scams. The scams threaten individuals, companies, governments, and organizations across the world. Computer hackers steal credit card numbers, bank account information, and tax records from individuals and corporations. Hackers steal credit card information online, then use it to conduct illegal activities. For example, a hacker can buy items online using a stolen name and information. The cost of these online attacks is huge. The Center for Strategic and International Studies is a policy research group in Washington, D.C. CSIS did a study in 2014 showing that cybercrime costs the global economy about $445 billion each year. The study found that the world's biggest economies suffer the greatest losses. The United States, China, Japan, and Germany had losses of $200 billion in 2014. Many companies have had software hacked by cyber criminals. Software tells a computer how to act and what to do. Major companies like Target and General Motors have been hacked. Individuals can be victims of cybercrime. Identity theft, when someone's personal information is stolen online, is one example. There are 15 million victims each year in the U.S. That's roughly the population of Moscow. Asher Kotz is a cybersecurity business expert in Fairfax County, Virginia. He said identity theft costs $50 billion each year. There is also a risk from cyber terrorists. Ted Koppel is a well-known American journalist. He wrote a new book called Lights Out, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. He writes that a major cyber attack on America's power grid is not only possible, but likely, said the publisher's website. The government has no plan to protect against such an attack, he warned. Nonetheless, the U.S. government will spend $14 billion on cybersecurity in 2015, said Kotz. This represents 16% of the total amount spent globally every year on information technology. Dan Woolley is general partner of Mach 37, a cyber accelerator at the Center for Innovative Technology in Virginia. An accelerator helps new cybersecurity startups and provides funding. He said threats on the Internet are constant, so new solutions must be devised continually. Hackers come from all over the world, reported Bloomberg. But the four countries with the most hackers are China, the U.S., Turkey, and Russia. Bulgaria and Romania also are centers for computer hackers, reported Reuters. Communist countries invested heavily in technology talent in the 1980s, Reuters said. International organizations collaborate to fight cybercrime, said Kotz. Governments, universities, and investors participate. The European Union is focusing on this issue. The EU is a political and economic union of 28 countries. Guido Londhier is Deputy Vice Minister for Foreign Trade at the Netherlands Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Next year, the Netherlands will serve as President of the EU. We are putting cybersecurity on the agenda and need cooperation internationally, Londhier said at the conference. Other organizations in Europe work with the U.S. on cybersecurity. This includes the Hague Security Delta in the Netherlands. Ida Haysma is director of the HSD. Haysma said the Hague Security Delta is Europe's largest security group with more than 200 partners. They include corporations, universities, and nonprofit organizations. Some U.S. states are targeting cybersecurity as a growth area for their economies. Virginia is one of them. Many government military agencies are located in Virginia. The region also has the largest presence of data centers in the U.S. and perhaps the planet, one expert said. I'm Mary Gottschall.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Fewer Americans believe in God, pray daily, and regularly go to church than in 2007, a poll says. More than 35,000 Americans were polled about their religious beliefs over 4 months in 2014 by the Pew Research Center. The study, called the 2014 Religious Landscape, was released recently. It updates research done 7 years ago. Kelly Jean Kelly has more.
The Pew Research Center said, the percentage of Americans who are absolutely certain God exists fell to 63% from 71%. One reason for this, the center says, is the large population of young adults, called millennials, who say they don't belong to any religion. The other reason is that older, more religious Americans are dying. The people who don't belong to a religion are called nones by the survey's writers. Nones made up 16% of the adult population in 2007. This time around, the number is 23%. Among the nones, about 61% said they believed in God. But the research center said there is a great deal of stability in the U.S. religious landscape, in spite of the lower numbers. Within the category of people who are affiliated with a religion, the numbers stayed mostly stable. 77% of the people surveyed said they were connected to a religion. In that group, 89% of those surveyed said they believe in God, which was only a small change from the last time the survey came out. Alan Cooperman, the Pew Center's director of religious research, says those who identify as religious are as observant as ever. On some measures, there are even small increases in their levels of religious practice. The survey asked Americans about a number of hot-button issues related to religion. The survey looked at Americans' views on homosexuality, abortion, and evolution. People who identified as Christian were about 10% more accepting of homosexuality than they were 7 years ago. Most Christian institutions officially oppose homosexuality. Views about abortion were mostly unchanged compared with the survey 7 years ago. 53% of Americans said abortion should be legal in most cases. about evolution, 62% of Americans said they believed humans evolved over time. 34% said they did not believe in that theory. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. The Blue Point Oyster is returning to the Great South Bay of New York after almost disappearing from the world marketplace. Over farming, pollution, and Hurricane Sandy had severely damaged the Blue Point Oyster business. Now the population is growing in its home on the coast of Long Island, about 100 kilometers from New York City. When the huge ocean storm called Sandy hit Long Island in 2013, it destroyed the Blue Point oyster beds. John Cochran is a councilman in the town of Islip. He pushed through a legislative measure to lease 1,200 hectares of the Great South Bay to shellfish businesses. 23 local fishermen, including the Cochran family, have signed up so far.
We have plots on this bay that were actually leased out by King George, and families still have a charter in Brookhaven from King George.
The Great Atlantic Shellfish Farms Company will be a major part of regrowing the oyster population in the Great South Bay. Marty Burns is an aquaculturist with the company. He is responsible for getting adult oysters to spawn, lay eggs, and produce the larvae that turn into millions of oysters.
Inside here is where all the larvae go after they have been spawned. The eggs and sperm have mated, and you actually have larvae swimming around here.
Marty Barnes grows the plant food of oysters, algae, in large tanks filled with salt water. The larvae absorb their algae diet for about 2.5 weeks. Then baby oysters appear.
Looks like a grain in the sand right now. It's amazing. Yeah. Nature.
After 6 weeks, millions upon millions of these little oysters are taken to farms in the bay. They are placed in wire boxes to grow to harvesting size. In 18 months, these oysters will be ready for market. Doug Winter is president of Great Atlantic. He says the oyster business has come a long way from the bay bottom harvesting of the 1800s.
With technology and advancements and the internet, people really being environmentally conscious, there's a big push for aquaculture. You can produce a lot more oysters. You can do it environmentally friendly. You can create reefs and clean estuaries and waterways. You can repopulate areas that have been depleted. And you can control your crop.
The Blue Point is back, and the oysters are not just good to eat. They are also good to the water. Each oyster can filter more than 150 liters of water a day, removing algae, nitrogen, and other pollutants. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. This week in our series, Morris Joyce and Frank Oliver continue the story of the man who served as America's 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland began his second presidency in 1893. His two terms were separated by the presidency of Benjamin Harrison. Cleveland took office again just as the United States was entering an economic depression. Businesses failed. Banks closed their doors. Workers lost their jobs. And farmers lost their farms. President Cleveland believed the depression was caused by the government's money policy. At that time, both gold and silver were used to support the value of the American dollar. In Europe, however, only gold was used. American investors and bankers were afraid their money would drop in value because of the use of silver. They began exchanging their money for gold. President Cleveland wanted to return to the gold standard, too. To do this, he had to urge Congress to kill a law which forced the government to buy silver. Before Congress began its debate, the president discovered a cancer in his mouth. The cancer needed to be removed immediately, but the operation had to be kept secret. News that the president's life was in danger could have an effect on the debate. It could make the nation's economic crisis worse.
So, the operation was done on a private boat in New York Harbor. Doctors removed some of President Cleveland's teeth and much of his upper left jaw. Then they removed the cancer. The operation took only a half hour. After a few weeks, doctors made Cleveland a new jaw out of hard rubber. He wore it without difficulty. A newspaper printed a story about the operation, but administration officials denied it. The facts did not become public for many years.
When President Cleveland returned to Washington, he sent a message to members of Congress. He urged them to kill the law which forced the government to buy silver. He noted how people throughout the nation had been exchanging their paper money and silver for gold. He said he was afraid the Federal Treasury would soon run out of gold. Then it would have only silver to support the dollar. If that happened, he said, the United States no longer could claim to be a major nation. President Cleveland said, "The people of the United States have a right to a money recognized as such on every exchange and in every market of the world. Their government has no right to injure them by financial experiments that are opposed to the policies of other nations."
After the president's message was read, the House of Representatives began its debate. A young congressman from Nebraska spoke in opposition to the president's position. His part in the debate made him famous throughout the nation. His name was William Jennings Bryan. Bryan said the United States should continue to make and use both gold and silver money. Using only gold, he said, increased the value of the dollar, and that made life difficult for America's farmers and workers. They had to pay more to borrow money, and for farmers, a more valuable dollar meant lower prices for crops. Bryan described the situation this way. On one side of the debate stand the business interests of the United States. On the other side stand the unnumbered masses. Work-worn and covered with dust, they make their appeal. But too often, their cry for help has sounded hopelessly against the outer walls, while others, less deserving, find easy entrance to the halls of Congress. The president is wrong to act on the demand of the business interests. He can no more judge the wishes of the great mass of our people by the words of these middlemen than he can measure the ocean's silent depths by the foam upon its waves.
No other congressman spoke as well as William Jennings Bryan. Yet his words could not save the silver purchase law. The House of Representatives approved President Cleveland's proposal to kill the law. The Senate did too. The United States was firmly on the gold standard. Everyone, especially President Cleveland, waited for the economy to improve. It did not.
More businesses failed. More workers lost their jobs. Tens of thousands of men left their homes to look for work. Some of these men began to unite in protest groups they called industrial armies. One industrial army was organized by a man named Jacob Coxey. Coxey proposed that the federal government should hire unemployed men to build roads. He said the government could borrow enough money to pay each man $1.50 a day. Coxey decided to take his proposal to Washington. He also decided to take his industrial army with him.
Coxey's army marched many kilometers from Ohio to Washington. Hundreds of unemployed men joined in along the way. But by the time the army reached the Capitol, only 300 men remained. City officials barred Coxey's army from meeting on public property. They barred them from asking people for food or money. Jacob Coxey was ready for the worst. He said, "If my men starve in the streets of Washington, the smell of their bodies will force Congress to act." Coxey tried to read a protest statement at the Capitol building. Police stopped him. The protesters then pushed forward in what police later called a riot. Several of the men, including Coxey, were arrested. A judge found Coxey guilty of violating public property. He sent him to jail for 20 days. Without Coxey's leadership, his army broke up. Its members went home. Yet the economic and social pressures which created Coxey's army did not ease. Protests and strikes continued throughout the nation.
The biggest strike started in Chicago against the Pullman Company, which made railroad cars. The man who owned the company, George Pullman, also owned the town where his workers lived. He owned the stores, the houses, the schools, and the library. When the economic depression began in 1893, George Pullman cut the size of his workforce. Those still working received less pay, yet Pullman did not reduce the cost of rent for his houses, Anyone who protested lost his job.
In the spring of 1894, a labor union organizer went to George Pullman's town. He was Eugene Debs, leader of the American Railway Union. Pullman did not want his workers to belong to a union, but he did not stop them at first. More than 4,000 workers joined. Immediately, the new union members voted to go on strike against the Pullman Company. Other members of the union supported them. They agreed not to work on trains that included Pullman cars. Within a few days, 60,000 railway workers were on strike. 20 railroads were closed down. Union leader Eugene Debs attempted to keep the strike peaceful, but he could not control strikers all over the country. So railroad companies asked the federal government for troops to break the strike.
The request involved a legal point. America's Constitution says federal troops cannot be sent to a state unless the state government asks for them, and no state government had asked for them. President Cleveland met with his cabinet to discuss the railroad company's request. They finally agreed to send federal troops to Chicago, where the strike had started, to enforce federal postal laws. The troops would protect trains carrying mail. The arrival of the troops led to more violence. Eugene Debs and other leaders of the American Railway Union were arrested. The Pullman strike ended.
President Cleveland faced increasing political problems. Organized labor denounced him for using federal troops to break up the Pullman strike. Farmers and Westerners attacked him for opposing the use of silver money. And everyone blamed him for not doing more to end the Depression. These political problems would have a great effect on the next presidential election. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Morris Joyce and Frank Oliver. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.